I'm Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, how exactly did the Supreme Court get so much power, and is that bad for America? We'll spend this hour with former Newsweek legal affairs editor David Kaplan, who says the idea that this unelected body of justices claims the power to shape social policies for decades should worry us all, whether the majority is conservative or liberal. We'll talk about the surprising side effects of major decisions, including Roe v. Wade, Bush v. Gore, and Citizens United. And we'll talk about why Kaplan believes we should consider term limits for justices rather than letting them work until they step aside voluntarily or die. Our conversation starts after a short break. When Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia died in his sleep at a friend's ranch in Texas, a lot of people were taken by surprise. He was 79 years old, but he hadn't been ill, and presumably he intended to stay on the court at least until the White House had a president who would choose a reliably conservative replacement. As it happened, of course, there were 11 months left in Barack Obama's second term when Scalia died. Democrats rejoiced at the assumption that their guy would get to put another liberal on the bench, a sort of bonus appointment who could shape social policy for decades to come. But Republicans also coveted the power of that seat and moved to run out the clock until after the 2016 elections on the grounds that the American public should have a chance through its choice for president to weigh in on a preference for a conservative or a liberal justice. After all, in the past half century, the Supreme Court has laid down the law on everything from abortion and marriage rights to campaign finance laws to the outcome of the 2000 presidential election. But wait, doesn't the authority to make those kinds of calls rest with Congress? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. David Kaplan is the former legal affairs editor at Newsweek. He now teaches journalism and ethics at NYU. He has real concerns about the growing frequency with which the high court overreaches its authority. And he makes the case that we should be bothered by this trend, whether or not the side we favor holds the majority. His book is called The Most Dangerous Branch, Inside the Supreme Court's Assault on the Constitution. David, welcome to Think.
Good to be here.
I think most Americans today assume that members of the Supreme Court are applying political ideology as well as legal logic to their opinions. Has that always been the case?
To some extent, it's always been the case, at least in the 20th century, but it's much worse now. This is really the first time where, one, you can pretty much predict how most justices will vote on key social issues, and two, their decisions seem to link up with the political party of the president who appointed them. Those justices appointed by Democrats vote one way, and those appointed by Republicans vote the other way. It wasn't always so. Sandra Day O'Connor, appointed by Ronald Reagan, was pretty much in the middle of the court. John Paul Stevens, appointed by President Ford, turned out to be liberal. Byron White, appointed by JFK, in the 1960s, turned out to be quite conservative. So a David Souter, appointed by the first George Bush, turned out to be very liberal. It's a lot, the vetting now is a lot better and a lot more cynical.
What is the high court supposed to do for the country, and what is supposed to be left to Congress to
decide?
Well,
that depends on who you ask, of course. The justices, and I interviewed a majority of them for this book on a background basis, I can't tell you which ones I talked to, all think, of course, they're doing exactly what they're supposed to be doing. Very few justices, very few judges in their careers are particularly skeptical of the power that they exercise. But there's nothing in the Constitution that explicitly spells out what the power is. But since the beginning of the Republic, the court granted unto itself the power to strike down acts of Congress, the power of judicial review. It's not spelled out in the Constitution. It's the ultimate example of justices, quote unquote, making law. And of course, justices make law. The old notion is when you hear in confirmation hearings, in addition to other things you hear in confirmation hearings, you hear that nominees only want to interpret the law. We're not going to make the law. But of course they make the law. The only difference is we say they make the law and we don't agree with the decisions they reach. But I argue in the book that over the last 50 years, pretty much beginning with Roe v. Wade, the key abortion decision, the court has reached out to decide issues better left to legislatures, which means Congress as well as state legislatures. You know, typically until Roe v. Wade, abortion was the province of state legislatures, not Congress. Same thing for gun control. Something like campaign finance regulation or voting rights, that was something more left to Congress. But I argue in the book that whether you're a liberal or conservative, Democrat or Republican, you probably ought to have more faith in democracy. I, for one, don't have a whole lot of faith in democracy these days. Look who's president. I'm a liberal by persuasion, but I think for purposes of this book, talking about the judiciary, I'm probably small c conservative. But I hope the book does not come across as partisan, because while I criticize rulings like the one that said there was a Second Amendment right to have a handgun for defense in your house, and I criticize Bush v. Gore, which awarded the presidency to George W. Bush in 2000, I also argue that Roe v. Wade should not have been decided the way that it was, and I argue that the same-sex marriage case from a few years ago probably should not have been issued when it was. The court probably should have deferred to whatever was going on in the states, maybe intervening later. I actually think that was a closer case than, say, Roe v. Wade, but I like to think the book is an equal opportunity offender to people on both sides of the aisle. But listen, you know, my own wife hates half the book. So so you can't please everybody.
Is there any reason to believe when you say that probably Congress should have decided the abortion question, or it should have been left up to the states to decide individually?
It's a state matter, sure.
Is there any reason to believe that we would be arguing less over abortion rights today had the court not ruled?
It's always hard to prove an alternative reality. Don't get me going on that. We're supposed to be talking about the court, not about national politics, right? But you can't prove it, but sure. If you look at what happened after Roe v. Wade, it only was after Roe that the country became as polarized as it was on abortion and that the Republican Party moved to the right. Back then, the Republican Party was fairly moderate. You have what were called Rockefeller Republicans. Nobody even knows what that term means anymore. And you could argue, you can sort of draw a line between Roe v. Wade in 1973 and the election of Ronald Reagan in 1980, that but for Roe, the party would not have been able, would not have had a rallying cry, something that would energize for the first time Southern evangelicals. That's part of the problem of Roe, having nothing to do with your own view on abortion. And my own personal politics, you know, policy politics on abortion are extremely liberal. The question is, who ought to be making that decision? And the trouble, when the Supreme Court constitutionalizes an issue, they take it away from legislatures. In a legislature, if you win today, you can lose tomorrow. And if you lose today, next year's you get another chance. So there's breathing room and anger and frustrations. Always have an escape valve. Once the Supreme Court rules, it's out of the hands of legislatures. And short of a constitutional amendment, there's nothing you can do other than hope to perhaps change membership on the court. Now, the court doesn't routinely change its own decisions. They're allowed to. But the court itself has partly been radicalized, and so too has the appointments process to become a Supreme Court justice. We've been hearing for 50 years confirmation battles that revolve around abortion and Roe v. Wade. And I argue in the book that's a bad thing. Now, after Brown against the Board of Education, 1954, desegregating public schools in the United States, the South fought, obviously, and criticizes the Supreme Court. So it's, I wouldn't make the argument that heated public debate over a court decision is a reason why the court shouldn't rule.
So you don't think Brown v. Board was overreach?
I think Brown, correct. I think Brown against the Board was one of the great moments in the history of the court. But the court, needs to be more modest, more restrained. It needs to pick and choose its issues. And you know, what's the difference between Brown and Roe? I mean, there's a whole chapter on that in the book, but it isn't necessarily the importance of the issue. You could argue that perhaps if you wanted, but the 14th Amendment's command about equal protection is quite explicit, notwithstanding that the court might have ruled in Plessy in 1896, another ruling, that they ruled the opposite way. it's hardly as clear looking at the text and the history and the competing policy concerns that Roe v. Wade is as obvious. Now, we don't want to spend the whole hour talking about abortion, but I think it's very difficult to equate the two issues.
You spend much of the early part of this book giving us what feels like a hidden camera tour of the behind-the-scenes areas in which the justices function, their relationships with their clerks, with each other. Not all of it is flattering.
You mean the gossip stuff.
I wonder why you felt it was important to let us see these people as flesh-and-blood people rather than, you know, wearing silk capes that fly in the wind.
Because that's who they is. I mean, I was lucky enough to get to talk to several dozen law clerks, again, on background, can't give their names, who they work for. But between talking to them and talking to the justices about themselves and about other justices, you get a glimpse behind the scenes of this very secret institution. And I think that's useful. It's interesting. It's fun. We know lots about presidents and senators and so forth. But it's good to see that they're just people. They wear black robes. They live in a marble temple, one of the great buildings in government in the world. But they're just people. And I thought giving a glimpse of that while also talking about some of the serious issues of constitutional policy and social policy would be interesting. And, you know, I continue to learn they're just people. I was at the court right around the time of the Kavanaugh unpleasantness back last fall, and I was seeing one of the justices on a social call, somebody still talking to me, and they said, the Chief Justice wants you to know that he does not have a bald spot. Because I had written, maybe a little snarky in the book, that the press office of the court has instructions that when the chief is in public, try not to have him photographed from behind because it shows the bald spot. You don't like that.
And try not to be taller than he is.
Correct. So then when the class photo shot 1 year with all the clerks and the justices, the chief asked two tall clerks who happened to be working for Justice Thomas to move away. I mean, you can't make this stuff up. So I asked the justice, I have two questions. One, why is the Chief Justice, of all the other things in the book, commenting on whether he has a bald spot? And two, Obama's crowd, inauguration crowd, was larger. The chief does have a bald spot. Look at the photographic evidence. I mean, come on. And the justice I was talking to smiled and said, no comment on both. And I said, are you telling me this because he was serious or was he kidding? And by the way, how did he even know we're going to be talking? And the justice smiled and said, also no comment. So, you know, I think most of it was in good fun. It was nice to know that at least two of them had read the book, but they're just people. If you watch the RBG documentary about Ruth Bader Ginsburg, she's a pretty cool, soft-spoken a character. But she comes across as a human being, and you know why? Because she is. It ain't Mount Olympus.
How much do you know about what takes place in what you call the sanctum sanctorum, the justices' executive conference room that nobody goes into but the nine?
No, well, during the conference, when they're meeting to vote on cases and discuss cases, nobody's in.
I'm sure somebody cleans it and all that.
I got a little tour because I begged and baked cookies, so I got to lose. And, I mean, when you realize that this is the room where Brown v. Board was decided and Roe was decided, so it's a pretty impressive room as conference rooms go. But among the things that surprised me is there isn't a lot of debate in that room. It's run quite efficiently. Roberts' predecessor as Chief Justice, William Rehnquist, was famous or infamous, depending on who you ask. Scalia hated that there was no debate. He wanted it to be like when he was teaching at the University of Chicago. He wanted to be able to debate the issues, and Rehnquist wanted to keep things moving. You know, you've had your 2 minutes, be quiet. Roberts lets everybody talk if they want up to 5 minutes, but they don't really weigh the merits. You've read the briefs, you'll hear the oral argument. It's time to vote. The case gets assigned and you move on to the next one.
David Kaplan is my guest. He's former legal affairs editor at Newsweek and has a new book out called The Most Dangerous Branch, Inside the Supreme Court's Assault on the Constitution. We'll come back to the conversation in a couple of minutes. You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Newsweek's former legal affairs editor David Kaplan, whose book is called The Most Dangerous Branch, Inside the Supreme Court's Assault on the Constitution. I want to ask you about your passages about Chief Justice Roberts, not about his hair or about his height, but about his kind of wish for greatness. This is something that you find that you place some optimism in. He would love to go down in history as being among the best Chief Justices.
Well, I mean, when you report out a book like this, you hope, as in journalism, but particularly in a book, you hope to hear something you've never heard before. And there's this great story where the chief is taking clerks from another chambers to lunch, and one of them says, "So how do you like the job?" And they expect a sort of reserved, reticent answer, "Oh, it's great, honor of a lifetime." And he says that, and then the Chief Justice says, "But I'll never have the chance for greatness. Only Chief Justice John Marshall, an early Chief Justice who served for 35 years and invented that power of judicial review to declare statutes unconstitutional." And, you know, the listeners were amazed that he's only the 16th Chief Justice in history. I mean, there have been 45 presidents. It's a pretty good gig, but Roberts really does want to be great. And now, by happenstance, he's the middle justice. As the politics plays out, he's the one who's going to be in the middle of a lot of key cases, in the way that Kennedy was for the prior 10 years and in the way that Senator O'Connor was for the 10 or 15 years before that. And Roberts wants to be great, and he has the potential to be so. And he is dealing with dueling wants. He is a conservative. Do not confuse him to be a moderate. He worked in the Reagan White House. He has been a political conservative his entire life. And he has pet projects. He thinks that racial preferences in voting, hiring, and so forth are unconstitutional. He thinks campaign finance regulation is largely unconstitutional, and he's ruled both those ways. But he also has great love of the institution and the prestige of the court. It's why he slapped Trump down. You recall last fall and comments about there are no Obama justices and there are no Trump justices, he said to Donald Trump. And for a chief to reach out and speak that way is astonishing. And you saw in the first Obamacare ruling in 2012, where he was the decisive vote to uphold Obamacare, 5-4 decision, and you saw him acting in a way that I think is consistent with a restrained view of the court's role. Now, will he do so in an abortion ruling next year, or in the partisan in voting rights cases? We'll have to wait and see. But he wrestles with both. I mean, I revealed in the book that in the Obamacare ruling, and he was going to be he was going to write the opinion as the decisive vote, and as the chief by definition senior, so he gets to decide who writes the opinion. He initially voted the other way, but he immediately went back to chambers and asked his clerks, directed his clerks to write competing opinions. And he ultimately, within a couple of weeks, went to the other side. Did he do so on the merits, or did he do so because he wanted to remove the court from the vortex, all the more in a presidential election year? He didn't want the court to be in the center of all that. That would be bad for the court. Which of those two reasons motivate him? I think the answer is both reasons motivated him, for exactly the reason that he spoke up last fall and criticized the president.
Is there—
And he is, whether you like him or dislike him, he is whip smart. When people ask me who's the smartest member of the court, and most of them, not all, are extraordinarily bright, I would say he and maybe Leda Kagan. He is really bright. He's really funny. He's really impressive. The interesting thing is when you talk to his colleagues, they all say that, but they don't all like him, which is interesting. They all love Rehnquist before him. They all dislike Berger before Rehnquist. But Roberts, for some reason, rubs some of them funny. Does that interfere with his ability to be chief? I think it'd be hard to argue that it does. But again, one of those interesting things you learn about when you work on a book for a year or two.
So President Trump has had the opportunity to make two appointments. Is he just more nakedly political when he talks about the things he wants in a Supreme Court justice, and when he says he hopes that the conservatives on the court will rule his way? Is he just more open about it? Does every president sort of hope and wish for the kind of treatment that, that President Trump openly admits he wants?
Pay no attention to the man in the booth. Look at the people behind the scenes. At some level, presidents rely on staff for all kinds of things. Bill Clinton and Barack Obama each taught constitutional law once upon a time, lawyers by training. They had more interest in sophistication in the details. Obama read all of Sonia Sotomayor's opinions on the lower court, and which ratified his instinct that he wanted to put her on the court. Donald Trump's not a lawyer. He hires lawyers. I hear one of them has been testifying of late in Congress, but Trump relied on his very able White House counsel for both those nominations, Don McGahn, and other really smart, talented lawyers in White House counsel's office and in government, many of them former Supreme Court clerks. That's where from his priorities come. I think he is simpatico with them, but I don't think anybody's confusing Donald Trump with a John Marshall or John Roberts in terms of legal sophistication, nor would they have confused Jimmy Carter if he had gotten to make a nomination or either of the Bush presidents. So Trump has indicated that he wants to satisfy the base and satisfy people on the right flank, and he was brilliantly able to do so with those two nominations. Think whatever you will about Brett Kavanaugh or Neil Gorsuch for that matter, but these are as advertised. Now, I argue in the book, because we were able to slip in some Kavanaugh stuff at the last minute, I think Kavanaugh will wind up voting closer to the Chief Justice. I think Kavanaugh is more of an institutionalist, not as much of a card-carrying member of the hard-right establishment. I think you may see Kavanaugh not necessarily vote in lockstep with Justices Gorsuch, Thomas, and Alito.
President Trump considered nominating Rudolph Giuliani to the Supreme Court?
Well, I mean, yeah, maybe for 10 minutes, but no. Rudolph Giuliani was never getting appointed to the Supreme Court. Would have been probably entertaining confirmation hearings, but no.
David, why has Congress ceded so much power to the court?
That's a really good question, and I asked a lot of members of Congress that question this time and 20 years ago when I wrote a book, The Accidental President, on, you know, the Florida aftermath of the 2000 election leading to Bush v. Gore.
We'll talk about that too, by the way.
An oldie but goodie. I think part of the reason, I mean, why is Congress incompetent? There are lots of reasons. Part of it is we elect a lot of chuckleheads to Congress, for lack of a better technical term. But part of it also is Congress understands that the Supreme Court is going to be the last word on any number of key issues like voting rights, like campaign finance, surely on the presidential election that was disputed in 2000. So why stick our necks out? The Constitution, as well as the federal statutes, spell out what you do in the case of a disputed presidential election. It's so clear that it's Congress's role and so clear that it's not the Supreme Court's role. And yet, when that case was appealed to the Supreme Court, nobody in Congress even spoke up, let alone wrote a brief to the court saying, excuse us, justices, that's our job. Step away from, you know, the edge and let us do our jobs. And at some level, who can blame members of Congress because they're tough issues? Why take the political risk when the justices across the street in the Marble Temple are going to have the last word anyway? You're seeing a little bit of pushback these days, maybe on the emergency declaration by Trump. You see some Republicans asserting congressional power, saying whatever we think on the merits of immigration and a declaration, it's Congress's. It's the power of Congress to appropriate funds, not the president. And you know, that was, I thought that was a small ray of hope on Congress's part. But Congress's impotence has been the case by and large for 50 years. And in the first instance, I argue it's the court's fault. In the same way, you can argue it's the court's fault that confirmation hearings have become so freighted. There's lots of blame to go around for why confirmation hearings have become the circus that they become, whether it's Kavanaugh, whether it's Gorsuch, or others before them. But part of the problem is when a single seat on the court is so important, when everybody knows that a single vote is going to determine critical social policies, then of course you're going to make the confirmation hearings the be-all, end-all. In 2016, polling showed that 25% of Trump voters voted for him, even though they didn't much like him or his policies, but because of how they thought he'd staff the Supreme Court, correctly so, given that he gave them Gorsuch and Kavanaugh. And about 20% of those who voted for Clinton, for Hillary Clinton, said they didn't much like her, but voted for her because they thought she would give them the kind of Supreme Court they wanted. Is that really the kind of power you want the Supreme Court to have? Is it really an unelected, nine unelected, unaccountable justices you want to have so much sway? You want them to have power on many issues. Where the democracy can't protect itself, where minorities, who by definition aren't going to win legislative majorities much of the time, then you need constitutional protection. First Amendment protections are never going to be popular. You don't need legislation to protect your right to espouse popular views, obviously. But if you're a white supremacist or a Nazi, the First Amendment was designed for you. And if you don't have a court backing up your right to be free from prosecution, persecution, then the First Amendment's a dead letter. I don't argue for an impotent court, but I argue for a court that is far more selective in exercising the power than it does. And even now, 20 years later, if you talk to some of the justices about Bush v. Gore, those who were on the court and those who weren't, they'll look at you and say, if not us, whom? And some of them, you know, will point out the window at Congress, recognizing that there are chuckleheads in Congress, and some of them will point further down the road toward the White House and say, we're the only grown-ups in the room, not recognizing, of course, that I would argue we don't need to be protected from ourselves. If we elected this president and we elected members of Congress, then we get the democracy we deserve.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. So the thing that everybody wanted to talk about when this book came out was your revelation that Justice O'Connor, former Justice O'Connor, has regretted her decision in Bush v. Gore.
Well, it had been known, I think, for a time that she regretted the court's intervention. Maybe the court should have stayed out and left it up in the first instance to Florida courts, and then ultimately it would have been Congress to resolve the issue. And you would have had, and we could talk about it if you want, you would have had a Bush presidency with Joe Lieberman, it could be argued, as vice president. You would have had a coalition government, which might have struck a lot of people as rough justice. But what I revealed in the book, you know, one of those tidbits you just come across, that O'Connor's husband, just a few months after the ruling in 2000, told guests at a dinner, at a table he was sitting, that Justice O'Connor knew the ruling was wrong at the moment she issued it, not regretting it 12 years later, which we already knew. And I was astonished that she voted the way that she did because she wanted to be able to get off the court to take care of her husband, who was becoming increasingly ill, eventually developed Alzheimer's, and she eventually did leave in 2005. To take care of him. She ultimately didn't leave in 2001 or 2002, as she might have hoped, but that she voted the way she did because she didn't want a Democrat in the White House, because then she felt she wouldn't be able to leave the court. Nothing wrong with wanting to leave the court when a president of your own party, quote unquote, leaves. Typically, justices do that in recent decades. But for her, according to her husband, who's now deceased, for her, according to him, to acknowledge that the decision was wrong at the outset is remarkable and bad.
to what extent do outside, you know, I think the court likes to portray this image of itself as being very aloof and above the fray. And as you mentioned, they live in a marble palace, or at least they work there.
And they don't come on NPR to do interviews,
right,
except when they have memoirs to peddle.
I did interview Justice Breyer, but he had a book.
Go figure.
But
a good guest.
Yeah, he was an excellent guest. But I have to say, you know, we don't have a lot of exposure to them. I mean, to what extent do outside groups and lobbyists, if you want to call it that, have an influence on the court? How seriously does anybody take an amicus brief that's filed?
Well, as lobbying is practiced in Washington traditionally, I think they're immune from that. Now, too many of the conservatives, by my lights, show up at the Federalist Society to give talks, and it looks really bad. Does it influence the justices? No. Do they take amicus briefs particularly seriously? No. And many of them have said that at law schools and in judicial conference meetings. They'll read them. And in the same-sex marriage case, some of the justices found them very persuasive. But for the most part, you know, if the ACLU or the Federal Society files a brief, you pretty much know what's coming. It has a tinge of partisanship in it. They're far more interested in what the lawyers actually arguing in the case have to say. And, of course, they're interested in what the clerks have written up in their memos to the justices. Having said that, the 1 hour of oral argument that's typically devoted to a case is important. It can be important in terms of testing out an idea in your own mind. It also can be important in effect, arguing to your colleagues. Since the conference that we talked about earlier isn't really used for law school debate, and since they don't do pop-ins into each other's chambers to debate cases, to the extent they want a debate or lobby, they'll do it in written memos. It's really 9 separate law firms at work. Oral argument can be the time where they try to win over a colleague.
David Kaplan is my guest. He's former legal affairs editor for Newsweek and has a book out called The Most Dangerous Branch, Inside the Supreme Court's Assault on the Constitution. We'll come back to the conversation in 2 minutes. You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with former Newsweek legal affairs editor David Kaplan about his book, The Most Dangerous Branch, Inside the Supreme Court's Assault on the Constitution. What do you make of Republicans' refusal to consider Obama's nomination of Merrick Garland? Do you expect Democrats to try and find a way to retaliate in kind at some point in the future?
Sure. And should, for example, RBG have to leave the court, for example, next February, 9 months before the election, sort of the same time frame that Scalia left the court involuntarily before the 2016 election, do you think that Mitch McConnell and other Republican senators are going to say, golly, I think we should wait till the election before we fill the seat? Of course not. I mean, I understand it's real politic, but it's pretty hard not to be a cynic to look at that situation. Now, listen, I hope the Democrats, should that possibility arise, and by all accounts, Ginsburg came out of her lung cancer surgery fine. Nobody's leaving the court anytime soon. But the Democrats just aren't very good at being bad, in my view. They're just not very good at playing hardball politics. And you could imagine a different situation, rearrange the chess pieces, make the Democrats, Republicans, Democrats. Would the Democrats have been able to hold the Senate together during a Republican administration if someone left the court? I'm not so sure. But I thought what was done to Merrick Garland in 2016 was shameful. It's not illegal, but it violates a norm concerning the court that had not happened before, despite the best efforts of Mitch McConnell to argue otherwise. And I mean, I revere the Supreme Court, and I revere its role as properly understood. But I think the best hope for the court, actually, is in effect to burn the place down before you can build it up. And if the Democrats were to take the White House in 2020, hold the House, and take the Senate, I would argue for them to pack the court. I didn't argue that in the book because I wasn't sure. But I now have the view that they should just add two seats to the Supreme Court. I mean, FDR talked about it in 1937. It was roundly criticized on both sides of the aisle. The proposal died quickly. The Supreme Court very quickly changed its view of New Deal legislation, maybe related to FDR's threat, maybe not. But things are so polarized now that I think it is conceivable that the Democrats and a Democratic president, Democrats in Congress and a Democratic president could, in a politically palpable way, convince the electorate to pack the court. Put two more seats on the court, doesn't take any constitutional amendment, just an act of Congress, make it 11 seats, and quote-unquote take back liberal control of the court. That's ultimately a bad thing because, of course, when the Republicans win,
suddenly
sometime down the road,
the
I mean, at a certain point, we're going to need a bigger building.
Yeah.
And that's destructive. But at some point, I think you might hope that at some point both sides will decide we need to disarm. This is not good for the court, and we need to start doing things differently. And maybe the court would recognize that it's time to practice what you preach. They're all in favor of judicial restraint, except, of course, in this case or that case. Everybody wants the court to be restrained. They've been preaching that for decades, long before this crew arrived. But I think that's ultimately the court's best hope. I argue in the book that I think Roberts has the potential to put the brakes on this court. But I think there are brakes in some cases, and I think he will pick and choose his battles, and he will try to convince someone like Kavanaugh to come along with him. But of course, you know, if Trump is reelected or Pence is elected in 2020, for example, and the Republicans keep control, by that point, Ruth Bader Ginsburg will be close to 90. Stephen Breyer will be in his mid-80s. At a certain point, Roberts is no longer in the middle of the court because they keep appointing Republicans keep appointing justices. At a certain point, Kavanaugh or Gorsuch becomes the so-called middle of the court. Then Roberts's position as chief to be a break is meaningless. He's just another vote. He jokes. He likes to say that one of the quirks of the Constitution is that the chief only gets one vote. But he only gets one vote.
I want to go back to something you said a little while ago, which is that 25% of people who voted for Donald Trump and 20% of people who voted for Hillary Clinton said, I'm not so crazy about my guy or my lady, but I really care about what happens with the Supreme Court. So that comes out to something like 25% of the electorate overall, which is interesting to me because, you know, we have survey after survey that finds that Americans can't name a single Supreme Court justice, which doesn't necessarily mean you can't comprehend what they're talking about.
Or think that Judge Judy is one of the justices, something like 16%.
So, I mean,
She's not.
Thank you for the clarification.
I knew you know, but just for... If my kids are listening somewhere.
You flatter me. Yeah. Should we be concerned that we think that we're, you know, that we're making decisions about who we want to elect to office based on the decisions they will make about who gets placed on the court? And a lot of us don't really understand very well how the court functions, what they do, and what their power is.
Sure. I think you ought to be concerned about that, as well as ignorance of the court. But even if they can't pick out Justice Alito in a lineup, they recognize the court's power. They still know that, as Justice Brennan, the liberal line of the court from the 50s to 1990, liked to say, he would hold up five fingers on his hand and say, with five fingers, you can do anything. And it was funny, but it was quite a statement of judicial power. I mean, I at some level, it was appalling. He did it to me once in an interview, and I smiled and laughed. But my hair stood on end. I was just, you know, a journalistic pup. I had recently graduated from law school. But it was a statement of judicial arrogance that was telling. And listen, Brennan was as effective a justice as the court has had maybe in history, and certainly in 100 years. But the electorate is not as stupid as you think it is sometimes. And they understand that the court makes social policy and, by and large, doesn't have a problem with it. It's one of the things I was trying to argue in the book, to try to educate readers that it may seem like the court ought to have that role, but A, it's not always had that role in American history, and B, is that really what you want? Do you really want judges making decisions about gun control, voting rights, campaign finance, abortion, and so forth? And I think most people just assume it's going to be that way because it's been that way in their lifetime. It's a very difficult argument to try to, as I've learned as the book's been out, it's a difficult argument to try to convince them because court power in that way is assumed. God knows they thought that in Bush v. Gore, awarding the presidency to George W. Bush. Of course the Supreme Court should be making the decision, which is what the justices thought. Well, no. Of course they shouldn't be. It's exactly what Congress was set up for. You can read about it in the Constitution. And we had a disputed presidential election in 1876, and they passed a statute setting up what's supposed to happen. I mean, again, I believe within boundaries. I believe in democracy. I don't always like the results, but until you're going to make me the monarch, I would much rather trust democracy than judges much of the time.
So the decisions that we talk about, write about, that are fodder for your work are the split ones. It's easy to overlook the fact that the majority of the court's decisions are unanimous. What are we to make of that? Are there some that are just obvious legal things and some that are purely political and never the twain shall meet?
I don't think it's so much political. A lot of the unanimous decisions were on really boring issues of statutory construction, of tax law and labor law. And ERISA, I wouldn't even tell you what ERISA, dealing with pensions and stuff. And you want to have a late night NPR show that's going to put people to sleep, it's to talk about those cases. But it's those key social issues that make the front page and that I write about in a book and that you and I would talk about on another occasion. They weren't always 5-4. That's just the way the political cookie has crumbled. By the way, many people will argue that what the court is ought to be in the business of doing is protecting individual liberty. And that's why abortion's a constitutional right, for example. The problem is there are others who will now start to argue, as they argued at the beginning of the 20th century successfully, up to and including 5 years of the New Deal, that liberty also includes a notion of economic liberty. And that things that we now take for granted as part of congressional power will once again be called into question. Some will argue minimum wage laws, maximum hour laws, are unconstitutional. They infringe on my economic liberty to do with what I want as my property. Zoning laws which prevent a smelting plant from being built next door to your home. You don't have a smelting plant next to your home, right?
I don't.
Right. Well, zoning laws are an infringement on economic liberty. For 80 years, we've assumed such regulations to be constitutional. It wasn't always so. And there are members of the Supreme Court who would like to see that prior era resurrected. If you accept an all-powerful court, then you have to accept an all-powerful court voting for different kinds of liberty when they have, as Justice Brennan put it, five fingers and five votes. That day's coming if Republicans keep appointing justices like Gorsuch and, to a lesser extent, Kavanaugh. And, you saw in late February, Justice Thomas issue a lone wolf opinion in a case involving libel law. You've heard this president say libel law needs to be changed, blah, blah, blah. He has no power over libel law, but the Supreme Court does. And Thomas, in this opinion, said that the law we've had for 50 years, making it extraordinarily difficult for public officials and public figures, college coaches, entertainers, and so forth, to be able to win a libel suit, is part of the First Amendment. The Supreme Court created that unanimously in a ruling called Tynes v. Sullivan in 1964, made libel law part of the First Amendment. Thomas challenged it. The commentators have all pointed out that in this case, as in perhaps others, he's a crackpot. The problem is, you should remember that in 1997 he said the same thing on gun control, and 11 years later there were 5 votes to declare an individual right to own a handgun was part of the Second Amendment. So justices change, views change.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. How hard would it be to create term limits for Supreme Court justices?
Impossible.
Why?
It would take a constitutional amendment. And the party in power, quote unquote, will never agree to it. If
whichever party is in power.
Correct. If the Democrats are in power and they're appointing justices left and right, or left and left, as the case may be, why would a Democratic legislature, why would a Democratic Congress, in the first instance, and then state legislatures, which have to ratify the Constitution Amendment, why would they support term limits? Why should we give up the advantage that we have now? Well, the answer is because you're being short-sighted. One day, you know, the Republicans will be in control, and vice versa. So I think the odds of that happening are nil. And if you talk to justices about it, of course it's a good idea for there to be term limits. When life tenure was established in the late 19th century, you know, people didn't live to be 90. Justices didn't serve for 30 years. Those rules were not created for the current era. But if you ask current justices, as I did, what do you think of term limits? They can't get beyond their own affection for the job. It's a great gig. Get summers off, write a few opinions a year. You have some of the smartest recent law graduates in the country as your law clerks. You work in a great building. I mean, come on. They all say, of course, term limits is a bad idea. There's not a very good argument against term limits, but it will never happen.
Before I let you go, just quickly, you've mentioned that, of course, there have been justices who have turned out to be more progressive or more conservative than the president who appointed them expected. Do their temperaments change over the years they sit on the bench?
Sometimes. But I think it is greatly overstated. I think if you're appointed when you're 50 or 60, you are largely made. Your perspectives can change. Sandra Day O'Connor, I think, convincingly would say that being around Thurgood Marshall for 10 years opened her eyes up to something she might not have thought about. And certainly, I mean, Byron White, a JFK nominee, turned more conservative, as best you can tell in his rulings. What was going on in his psyche or his heart? You know, who can tell? His papers aren't particularly revealing. He didn't do interviews. Did David Souter become more liberal on the court? Did John Paul Stevens? Maybe. But they would argue that no, it's the rest of the court that went in the other direction.
David Kaplan is the former legal affairs editor at Newsweek. He now teaches journalism and ethics at NYU, and he's the author of The Most Dangerous Branch, Inside the Supreme Court's Assault on the Constitution. David, thank you so much for making time for us today.
This was great. A pleasure. Thank you.
You can follow us on Twitter at KERAThink and use any podcast app to become a subscriber to the Think podcast. We have 9 new episodes a week. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.